Jacob is on his way back from Paddan Aram to the land of Canaan, having escaped from his uncle Laban, who has mistreated him over 20 years of active service. Jacob has fled. Laban has pursued him and eventually caught up with him. And in that encounter, the two men agree to a covenant of peace, a covenant of non-confrontation. Jacob will not pass beyond a pillar and a pile of stones that have been set up as markers between them and a reminder of their covenant. He will not pass beyond them to do Laban any harm. And Laban would not pass beyond them to do Jacob any harm. They will live in peace with one another, and their paths need never cross again. This covenant with Laban means that the past for Jacob is history. He never needs to return there again. And so the story continues in the 32nd chapter of Genesis. Jacob went on his way, and no doubt he went on his way with a certain spring in his steps. He does no longer fear the pursuit of Laban. Peace is between them. But moreover, we suddenly encounter Jacob in a meeting with divine providence. The angels of God met him in the way. It's a reference to a prior encounter with angels when, during a dream in the night, in a place that Jacob would call Bethel, he sees angels descending and ascending on a ladder between himself and heaven. These angels now meet him on the road that he is taking back to the land of Canaan. And when Jacob saw them, he says, "This is God's camp." And he called the name of the place Mahanaim, or two camps. It may be a reference to the fact that this is a second camp of angels, of God, or it may simply refer to the fact that his camp is here, but also encamped alongside him are the angels of God. But no doubt this encounter with the angels encourages Jacob. It suggests that his future is accompanied by the kind providence and promise of God. Those promises that God himself had spoken to Jacob when last he met with these angels. "Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." Ah, these angels that meet him on the way are a proof of God's faithfulness. Of course, the large flocks and herds that accompany Jacob and the family that is his are also proof of God's faithfulness. And so Jacob renews his journey with confidence and expectation. But not everything works out exactly the way that Jacob anticipates. And indeed, he himself has something that he needs to do. There are six things in this passage, in chapter 32 of Genesis, that we need to give some attention to. The first is the renewed hope that Jacob has on his return to Canaan. We see it expressed in verses 3 to 5. We're told that Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants, female servants. I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight. Jacob is seeking reconciliation with his brother. The fact that he has made peace with Laban and that chapter of his history is now behind him, the fact that he has re-encountered the angels of God, and there is this renewed expression then that God is with him, encourages Jacob to send his servants in order to be reconciled to his brother Esau. You know, this wasn't an absolute necessity. Esau had made his home, as the text tells us, in the land of Seir, in the country of Edom. It was a long way south of where Jacob was at this point. And not only that, Jacob didn't need to go there at all. It was not on his route. He need never see Esau again. But he desires peace with his brother. I've said a number of times as we've gone through this story of Jacob, but through these 20 years in Laban's service, Jacob has become a changed man. His experiences there under Laban's deceitful home and providence has caused Jacob to realize something about himself. The way that God has blessed him has encouraged him with the promises of God that he will be faithful to them. And he's a man who has changed in his focus in life. He used to be a man who felt that anything that needed to be done, he must do himself. Now he's a man who is more inclined to trust God, to follow God. And so he seeks to be reconciled to his brother, realizing that however much what he did was the actual outcome of God's providence, the fact that he was destined to be lord over his older brother, he was destined to inherit the blessing that God had first given to Abraham and then to his father Isaac, and which in the normal, natural course of events would have gone to Esau. He realizes that all of that is the plan of God, but at the same time he realizes that the way that he has achieved those things was through deceit and cunning. He realizes that to that extent, then he has robbed his brother and ill-used his brother. And so he seeks a reconciliation with his brother by sending his servants out of the route that he is taking down to the country of Seir to tell him that God has blessed him and that he wishes the favor of his brother on his return. The messengers return, though, and Jacob's renewed hope in these providences that he's recently experienced is suddenly shattered. And replacing the hope that he had is fear. The messengers returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. Why would Esau be bringing 400 men with him? There could be only one answer in Jacob's mind. Commentators suggest that this was the usual size of a militia. Some make reference to David in his years as an outlaw fleeing from Saul, and the fact that 400 disgruntled men attached themselves to David. Well, that happens centuries later. Nevertheless, it is very apparent that however we might have read this company of men and what it meant, Jacob understood it to be something distressing. He is filled with fear. He divides the people with him, the flocks, the herds, the camels, into two camps. He says, if Esau comes against one camp, that's his assumption, why else have 400 men, then the other camp will escape. From hope to fear. From confidence to distress. Isn't that so often the way we are? He's forgotten the angels that he's seen. He's forgotten the promises of God that had filled him with so much hope. And now he's fearful. And he divides his camp and he prepares for an attack. But that's not all that Jacob does. 20 years earlier, that may have been all that Jacob would have done, but not anymore. And we discover in the third place that Jacob bows in prayer to God. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred that I may do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Jacob prays. He's full of fear. He makes plans, but he also prays. And his prayer is an interesting prayer. His prayer, firstly, is remarkable for its humble confession. He confesses this great God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the covenant God. He uses the name Yahweh, the Lord. He is a great God. But in contrast with this great God, Jacob acknowledges that he is an unworthy servant. I'm not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. And he expresses the way that he has seen God's faithfulness and his steadfast love evidenced. I came across this Jordan with just my staff. And here I am, I'm returning. And I've become two camps. This has been the steadfast love of God, the faithfulness of God. Jacob acknowledges that in all of these 20 years, it hasn't been by his cunning. It hasn't been by his strategies. It hasn't been by his cleverness or by his hard work and diligence that he has become two companies. It is because of the steadfast love of this great God, the God of his fathers. Having acknowledged in this humble confession that he is unworthy before such a great God, he nevertheless presents an earnest petition. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. From the hand of this wild man of the field. He expresses his need. He acknowledges that God must deliver him. And he pleads with God to do so. He fears an attack. And he knows that he has not the resources to thwart an attack. The most he can do is to divide his camp into two and hope that somehow he may preserve at least half of what he owns. But he pleads with the Lord for full and complete deliverance. And then we see in this prayer sound reasoning. Yes, he fears Esau. He fears what Esau could do, but he acknowledges that God has made a promise. You said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. You said, return to your country and to your kindred that I might do you good. I am here because you told me to be here. Jacob is saying to God, now, since I am doing what you told me to do, please deliver me. And since you have already shown your steadfast love and your faithfulness to me over these 20 years, show your steadfast love and your faithfulness to me now. At this point of extremity, of this great need in my life. And so Jacob lifts this prayer to God and pleads with God to be merciful to him. And so Jacob sits back, perches on a stone to see what God will do. No, he doesn't. He makes plans. Having reconsidered his immediate response to the news that Esau is coming with what appears to him to be a small army, Jacob now determines that he will seek to appease Esau's anger. It was a justified expectation that Esau would be angry. Jacob's fear is not ungrounded. Esau had said, the days of the mourning of my father are approaching and I will kill my brother. Jacob had fled for his life and he feels that now he might need to do the same, but perhaps he can, through a gift, a generous gift, an abundant gift, appease the wrath of his brother. And so he makes these plans. Plans that by his prayer he's already acknowledged to be useless in and of themselves. But he also understands, through 20 years of service under Laban, that while God is faithful and his loving kindness does not waver, he doesn't expect us to sit back and do nothing while he does all the work. Jacob has learned that we also must act, and so he acts. He sends this present, and it's a tremendous present. 200 female goats and male goats, hundreds of ewes and rams, camels and donkeys, cows and bulls. All of this drove by drove, and he plans it carefully sending each drove separately with a space between them so that the first present will come and Esau will encounter that servant and find out what this is all about and be taken aback by the generosity of his brother Jacob. And then a little while later, another gift. And a little while later, yet another gift. And this is what Jacob hopes will have an effect upon his brother. This isn't a boastful demonstration of his own wealth. Look, Esau, look what I've got. But rather, this is a sincere desire to bless his brother. He had stolen his brother's birthright. He had tricked his brother out of his blessing. This great wealth had come to Jacob because of that. And now Jacob wishes to bless his brother by giving out of the wealth with which God has blessed him. It is a sincere desire on Jacob's part to be reconciled to his brother, to put right what had gone wrong. And so this great present begins the journey south towards Esau, who's travelling north from Seir. In the meantime, that same night in which these presents pass on ahead of Jacob towards Esau, Jacob takes his family and he crosses the ford of Jabbok. In the middle of the night, it would appear that this is taking place, not the safest of activities to perform in the night time. But he makes sure that this river is between him and his brother. And then he settles down for the night so that if his brother comes during the night, he will be the first one to meet him. And Jacob is left alone. And suddenly, a man appears and wrestles with him. And a combat takes place. It's an encounter that puzzles commentators. Why should this happen? What is its significance? And who was this man? Well, Jacob himself acknowledges who this man was when towards the end of this section in verse 30 he says, "I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." Hosea echoes that conclusion when he makes reference to this encounter in the 12th chapter, speaking of Jacob. Hosea says, "In his manhood, he strove with God. He strove with the angel and prevailed." This was a divine combatant. And what is happening in this combat is a, as one commentator put it, a kind of parable of the life of Jacob. Jacob had fought with his brother over a birthright. He had fought with his father over a blessing. He has fought with his uncle over his daughters and his wealth. And now he's fighting with God. It's a reflection of who Jacob was. Jacob the deceiver, the cheat, the supplanter, determined to have his own way and to succeed whatever it took. This had been Jacob's life. But it's a lesson also in frailty. It confronts Jacob with his own frailty. Now, we've already seen that Jacob was a man to be reckoned with, not just in terms of his cunning, but also in terms of his physical strength. When he first went to Laban's house, we saw him move a capstone over a well single-handedly that would normally require a number of people to shift. We think of Esau as being the burly huntsman and of Jacob as being tied to his mother's apron strings. But that wasn't the case, and we see this reflected again in his encounter with this man. They fought, they wrestled until the breaking of the day. Well, let's assume that this man came to him in the middle of the night. We've allowed time for Jacob to prepare this present for his brother and sent them on their way. And perhaps it's 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, maybe even 3. But 2, perhaps 3 hours, some reckon as many as 6 hours passed as these men wrestle with one another. But this divine combatant does not prevail against Jacob. Jacob's a man to be reckoned with, certainly. And yet, with a touch, he's immobilized. Oh yes, Jacob may be a man of strength, and he may be a man of courage, and he may be a man of cunning, but nevertheless, in the end, he's a man. He has the frailty of all men. And God uses this combat as a way of showing Jacob that this is the case. And through it, Jacob recognizes that he needs God and God's favor. The man said, "Let me go, for the day has broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Jacob would have had no idea who this man was as the battle began. But having had his hip touched and his leg dislocated, he realizes that he has been up against a divine opponent, and he desires a blessing from this one. Previously, he had been fighting in a position of strength. Now he simply clings to him in a position of weakness. And the combat then leads to confirmation. Confirmation that Jacob is God's man. This man asks him, "What is your name? Who are you? What is your character? What makes you tick?" You can almost see Jacob hanging his head in shame and saying, "My name is cheat. My name is deceiver. My name is supplanter. My name is Jacob." And then this man says to him, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Jacob makes a confession. He is the great deceiver. He is the trickster par excellence. This has been his life. And God in his grace says, but you're a changed man, Jacob. You're a changed man. You are no longer Jacob. You are now Israel. Now the word itself, though you may have it footnoted in your Bibles as meaning he strives with God or God strives, that is really a guess more than a certainty. God is in there somewhere, indicated by the part of the word El, but the rest of it is uncertain. Nevertheless, the idea certainly is tied to this prevailing. And the idea then would convey that of him being a battler, a warrior, God's warrior, perhaps. He's no longer the man who by his own strength and ingenuity and cunning gets his own way. He is now the man who serves God, who battles for God, who honours God. He's a changed man. And God blesses him. Jacob asks the name of this man. He says, why do you ask my name? He doesn't really need to know. He knows who he is. He confesses himself, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. More than that, he has been favoured by God. God blessed him. In this encounter with this divine combatant, Jacob has come to the end of himself. And he's found God's blessing. He had been a changed man before, but now he has come to the climactic conclusion that nothing that he does, all the plans that he has, all the things that he does in order to avoid the hatred and the animosity of his brother or whatever else it may be, is nothing. God is everything. He is weak. God is strong. And it was not until his weakness was realized and the full extent of his weakness was realized as he clung to this divine combatant and pleaded for a blessing that Jacob finds the blessing of God. For when we are weak, God's strength is made perfect. Jacob comes to the end of himself. And he bears for the rest of his life a reminder of this contest. A limp and a name. A name by which his descendants will be known forever. Hope gave way to fear. Prayer was accompanied by plans. And a combat led to confirmation that God's blessing was upon his chosen servant. Through all the changing scenes of life, in trouble and in joy, the praises of my God shall still my heart and tongue employ. Of his deliverance I will boast. till all that are distressed from my example comfort take and charm their griefs to rest. We need to take from the example of Jacob to realize that, yes, we must act as Jacob wisely did, but we must also pray, because our strength is nothing, and in our weakness, he is strong. So may we learn that even in the most hopeless of circumstances, if we are in God's place, then God is with us. If we're doing God's will, he will fight for us. And if we're honoring God in our lives, he will bless us.